Hello, my name is Elizabeth Porowski. I'm the Communications Manager at Alicat Allies. I'm joined by Dr. Tammy Bryant. Dr. Bryant is a UCLA professor and teaches, among other subjects, animals and the law. She also ran the UCLA Cats on Campus program from 1989 to 2009. In 1998, she was the lead drafter of California state legislation to shift animal sheltering from killing to saving lives. This legislation is known as the Hayden Law. That legislative work resulted in her serving as a consultant regarding the extent to which the animal shelter legislation was a state mandate requiring reimbursement of local government. Dr. Bryant, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
As I said in your introduction, you were involved in the drafting of the Hayden Law, a bill enacted in 1998 that focused animal pounds and shelters on saving animal lives. What was the genesis of this law and how did it become enacted?
The Hayden Law was initiated by then State Senator Tom Hayden, who came from the Los Angeles area, but who was actually concerned about the extent of killing in animal shelters throughout the state of California. Before he ever even introduced the law, he asked for research to be done. So three of us did survey research of a sample of public and private shelters operating in California. We discovered that there were a number of specific practices which, if addressed through comprehensive legislation, could predictably reduce the extent of euthanasia, the extent of killing that was being done in our animal shelters.
The Hayden Law had a strong set of policy goals. The first one stated that public and private shelters and humane organizations share a common purpose in saving animals' lives, preventing animal suffering, and eliminating animal abandonment. How did you come up with that goal, and why did you decide to state it first?
Part of that, I think, is just part of the process by which you introduce legislation of this type. It was a very large, comprehensive bill, and so it needed to be presented with an overarching thematic goal. But another part of the answer to your question is that our research indicated that there wasn't as much collaborative sharing of resources and solutions to problems among rescue groups, private shelters, and public shelters as there might be in order to provide efficiencies for the individual shelters, to provide more effective means of people reuniting with their lost pets, and to provide more opportunities for animals to be adopted from shelters and through rescue groups.
One significant way the Hayden Law attempts to save lives is to allow nonprofit animal rescue and adoption groups to take animals, including feral cats, out of shelters where they would otherwise be killed. Can you tell us how important you think this provision was?
At the time that the law was enacted, I thought that this provision would be very important because testimony that came in during the legislative process and part of our research indicated that many animals could be saved if shelters would be willing to transfer animals to animal protection groups, be they groups focusing on feral cats or groups focusing on cats that could be and dogs that could be rehomed. And one of the reasons we discovered was most prominent in this reluctance to work with such rescue groups is that rescuers would sometimes be critical of the shelters in ways that were offensive to shelter managers, and so they were reluctant to work with their critics. I think also working with rescue groups was like working with the public. Our shelters in California weren't particularly public user friendly. I think an attitude had developed in the California shelters such that the public was cast as exclusively irresponsible, that they were seeing the members of the public who wanted to relinquish pets, who they were seeing the effects of abandonments of cats to become strays. They weren't dealing as much with that part of the public that wanted to find their pets and wanted to find new homes for animals whose owners didn't find them in time. And so the ability of rescue groups to be able to go into the shelters and to help with the placement of animals seemed to me at the time to be important to enact legislatively, since it wasn't something we were seeing happening naturally through the dealings between rescuers and shelter personnel.
The Hayden Law is one of the earliest state laws to talk about feral cats and to define them in terms of their socialization to people. What made you want to be sure that feral cats were included in this bill?
Frankly, I didn't want to include feral cats as a separate cat population in shelters. And the reason that I didn't want to include them was that by the time that amendment was taken, it actually was an amendment, it wasn't part of the original law. By the time the amendment was taken, all the shelters had agreed that the hold period for cats included feral cats. And so to include feral cats seemed to me to pose a number of problems, potentially for feral cat caretakers. One problem that I was really worried about was identifying feral cat colony caretakers as owners of the cats, because that could trigger nuisance claims against the owner. It could trigger mandatory spay-neuter requirements in ways and at times that would be difficult for the feral cat colony managers to comply due to financial resources or other kinds of problems. So I was actually very worried about the provision. I was required to include a provision about feral cats in order to get buy-in from some of the organizations that were opposed to the Hayden Law generally. The argument that they made in the context of feral cats was that it was cruel to keep feral cats in cages for the extended holding period. So perhaps I ought to explain a little bit about that holding period. The holding period before the Hayden Law was enacted was a mere 72 hours from the time of capture. There was very little time for people to find their lost pets, let alone for rescuers, many of whom are volunteers with full-time jobs, to get to the shelters. Here in Los Angeles, for example, we have 6 city shelters, and animals are moved between and among the different shelters for reasons of space, care requirements, for a variety of reasons. So 72 hours was just way too short a period of time. And so we began searching for a reasonable time frame. We looked at other states at the time. 72 hours placed us at the bottom 6 states. We looked for other models. We looked to the Humane Society of the United States standards in their sheltering division. Those standards were in the 5 to 7 day range. We looked at the federal law that pertains to shelters selling animals into animal research facilities, the minimum hold period for animals who are going to be sold into those labs was 5 days to give owners a chance to find them. So we really used those types of data points as indicative of where we should be aiming as a state in California. So we chose 4 or 6 days. And the reason we did that was that we found during our research of the shelters operating in California that they were very often open during times that the public couldn't easily access them, and they were closed when the working public could get off work and go look for their pets or adopt new pets. So the provision that we put in the Hayden Law was that you have a holding period if you're a shelter of 6 days unless you provide weekend evening hours, and it was framed in terms of each animal. Each animal has to be available for adoption or owner redemption, either on a weekday night or a weekend day, for that animal to be held for only 4 days instead of the 6 days. So we tied our holding period to hours of operation criteria. One of the complaints we got was about feral cats and keeping them in cages for 4 or 6 days. And while there are arguments to refute that position, such as the length of time it takes people to reclaim their cats, the difficulty of identifying a feral cat versus a simply terrified tame cat, all of these are objections that we presented to those who wanted to see a particular provision for feral cats. They fell on deaf ears. And so I confronted this problem that feral cats were going to be held for a shorter period of time. How were we going to define a feral cat in order to avoid sweeping in cats who were tame but terrified, or tame but generally fractious cats? And so that is the origin of the definition of a feral cat by reference to a spectrum of behaviors and socialization. And while we wanted feral cat caretakers to be able to come and get their cats, we didn't want them to be exposed to liability as owners. And so we created ambiguity by stating that feral cat caretakers or owners could reclaim. I think the way we phrased it was that feral cats are cared for or owned by people in order to further that ambiguity about ownership issues. Ultimately, what happened was that we had to insert a temperament testing provision so that at the end of the third day, cats would be tested, and if they did not test as tame or sufficiently tame on the tame end of the spectrum, then the holding period could terminate at that point. The law did not require killing cats at that particular point in time. The law only gave the shelter the option of concluding the holding period. They could transfer those cats to another organization that was able to deal humanely with feral cats, for example, but it definitely did shorten the holding period for feral cats, and that was not something that I was happy to see happen to the Hayden Law, and so I reluctantly agreed to that amendment.
How do you see the state of animal law in California today? Apart from reinstating funding to local governments for portions of the Hayden Law that were suspended due to the budget crisis, what do you think should be the next step to improve laws for animals in California?
I feel fortunate many times in being located in California because there are so many energetic, intelligent animal activists seeking legal change, either through the legislative process in Sacramento or through going directly to the voters and seeking change through the ballot process, initiative process here in California. I can think of many areas of animal law that are ripe for legal change, but specifically with regard to issues that have come up in the context of the Hayden Law or issues that have come up with respect to animal sheltering in California, there are some specifics that I think may be important. I think that more animal law being generated, being considered at the local level, may be more effective in accomplishing some animal advocacy goals than seeking statewide legislation as to some issues. Statewide, we are experiencing so much financial difficulty, and so much attention is being focused on the structure of government, how decisions are made, specifically how decisions are made about financing, that there may be fewer options for us to accomplish as much at that level. I also find that at the local level, local officials, city officials, city governors, tend to be able to consider issues without as much influence being exercised by organizational lobbyists concerned about maintaining the status quo as to animal exploitation. On the local level in particular, more attention to those mechanisms that enable people to respond to animal problems humanely seems to me to be a viable approach. Recently, we've seen local legislation to restrict the decline of cats to therapeutic surgeries only. I think at the local level where we look more at creating laws for the funding of spay-neuter, where we create opportunities rather than creating mandates that people will have difficulty addressing, may be a more productive way to go. So, at the local level, facilitating avenues by which people can contribute to funds for a variety of animal protection issues, funding that is then available for tax deductions on the basis of charitable contributions for not just spay-neuter, but also other animal sheltering kinds of activities that make it easier for animals to get out of our shelters. Those seem to be the kinds of issues that local people can get behind. And not being able to address those issues at the local level, thinking that many of those issues need to take place at the state level, seems to me to leave this untapped potential.
At Alley Cat Allies, we regularly talk about the difference between punitive laws and incentive-based laws. Do you see those working in different ways for animals?
My understanding of a punitive-oriented law is a law that creates penalties for not doing something, for not spaying and neutering, for example, not taking care of your animal. There have been a lot of laws proposed that would require the provision of veterinary medical services, and you would be in violation of anti-cruelty laws if you don't provide veterinary medical services. And there are several problems with these penalty-based laws. One problem is the resources necessary for enforcing these kinds of laws, and the reluctance of courts to place on someone the stigma of conviction for animal cruelty or as being a non-law-abiding citizen for infractions of these penalty-based laws. So one set of problems goes to enforcement kinds of issues. Another set of problems that I think stem directly from penalty-based laws has to do with the message that they send to people who would be affected by them, that you need to be threatened in order to do something that is either a compassionate thing to do or a sensible thing to do, as though people would not do those things but for the threat of a penalty. And what we found in many situations is that people will, for example, spay-neuter their cats. They will provide vet medical services if they are given opportunities to do so at a cost that they can afford. And so the other category you provided was these incentive-based laws. Incentive-based laws, or laws that enable people to do the compassionate thing, are laws that are respectful of people as well as being respectful of animals. And they create an opening for people who want to help other people to contribute to the process. So let's take the example of laws that enable funding to be set up that's administered in such a way that people can donate money for, or services if you're a veterinarian, donate for the purpose of spay-neuter, and then a means by which we can connect up people who can't afford spay-neuter services to the funding mechanism that we've put in place. Those are enabling laws. Those are laws that enable people who already have spayed and neutered their cats to make spay-neuter available for people who can't afford to spay and neuter. We create then more awareness of need and more awareness actually of the variety of compassionate responses we can have to animal problems. And that's just one example. If we look for ways by which governments can put in place these incentive-based rules and laws, I think that we'll get more people excited about animal protective legislation.
Can you tell us how you became interested in animal law and your background in animal protection?
I originally joined the UCLA law faculty with a specialty in Japanese law. Shortly after I received tenure from the law school and the university, I went to Japan on a Fulbright fellowship to continue my studies of Japanese law, Japanese family law. While I was there, I commuted to the courts every day, and one day I rounded the corner and saw this monkey in a birdcage. And I suppose that's the event that kind of tipped me in the direction of evaluating what I wanted to do with a substantial portion of my academic professional life. I came back from that Fulbright experience in Japan and approached the deans at the law school with the idea of offering an animal law course. The deans at that time were very receptive. They had the approach that faculty ought to be given a lot of encouragement and autonomy in the selection of the courses and the research that they thought would be important. So I had a wonderful, ideal situation with which to begin teaching animal law in 1994.
The animals in the law class that you teach at UCLA, what subjects do you actually cover?
I cover a basic survey course in my Animals in the Law class. I have taught other specialty courses in which I've focused on particular subjects. I had one course on animal shelter law, for example. I've taught seminars that focus on other aspects of animal law. But in my basic core class, Animals in the Law, I focus on the populations of animals that I group as companion animals, animals exploited for food production, animals used in research, wild animals, animals used in entertainment.
I think it shows a legitimizing trend for animal rights and animal protection movement for these classes to be offered and to address these issues in general. Has the class received a good response from your students?
That's an interesting question. A certain number of students who sign up for animal law and discover that it's going to cover the topic of the food they eat decide that this isn't a time in their lives when they want to confront some of those issues. A not insignificant number of students also express reservation about tackling emotionally difficult material while they are in law school, having to master some very difficult areas of law and needing to stay focused on their career goals. As to those students who actually stick it out and take the course in animal law, there has been very positive evaluation of what the course has offered to them in terms of learning what the law is generally. Animal law deals with so many different subjects in law. There are tort law issues, there are constitutional law issues, there are administrative law issues. Of course, there are criminal law issues because of the importance of anti-cruelty statutes and a consideration of animal law. So students sometimes say that it's such a good overview course for them in learning about all areas of law, a kind of positive evaluation I might not have expected in the beginning. And of course, there are also students who say that it has affected how they think about local community animal issues that come up, such as the existence of feral cats in their community or the animal shelter issues that come up and that are talked about in the news. So students seem to become more aware of many types of issues and how the law influences those kinds of issues than before they took the class.
Well, Tammy, I'd really like to thank you for joining us today and sharing your expertise. It was great to have you.
Thank you.